You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
How would you describe public service broadcasting to someone who'd never heard of them before?
I'd normally say, it's kind of primarily electronic music with guitars and drums, but with spoken word samples from kind of public information films or feature films or archive, woven together. I'm not the best at talking about that aspect of it, I'm afraid. It's quite hard to put into one sentence because it's a relatively unusual thing, I think.
You are an instrumental band of sorts. Would that be a reasonable observation?
Well, it would be, but then, on the last album, there's probably vocals on about 4 out of 11. So, overwhelmingly, it's been instrumental in the past, but we're not against singing on principle. It's just been the way that things have kind of worked out with the material we've been working with so far.
When did you develop an interest in historical audio?
I started kind of mucking around with it for my own amusement in about 2008. Not really for anything to do with the historical side of things, but more just because it was a human voice that I could put on top of the electronic music I was making, and it would give it a kind of human angle. It was more for the kind of the sonic character of the voice as much as anything else, just the sound of these old recordings. It just kind of felt like it gave it a sort of otherworldliness that you couldn't get just with an instrumental piece. So it was, that's how it got started. And then really, as I kind of started writing more and more, I realized you're only tapping into a certain part of the potential of it if all you're using it for is the sonic part of it. If you start using some of the more historical side of things, then you can really kind of pack a bit more of an emotional punch with the stuff that you're talking about, and that's where it all kind of really got going.
What sort of comes first? Because I guess you end up telling a story with the audio. Does like the narrative from the old audio sort of come first and then the idea for the song comes afterwards? Or is there a place that they meet in the middle where you blend the two together and you write a song while you're combing through all this old audio?
Yeah, it's more the latter, really. I mean, they're both out there and they both kind of meet in your brain. That doesn't sound too weird. You're kind of developing one side of it. You might be writing music, a thing, that might work with something about this kind of thing, or you've got a couple of ideas stowed away, and then you start researching a particular topic, and either that sort of fires off an idea of the kind of music you'd like to create, or reminds you of an idea you've had, or you have a piece of music and you go in search of the archive that's going to match it. It really depends on the material. I knew I wanted to write something exciting about Apollo 11, but I didn't know what it was going to be, and then it was really only when I heard those call-outs, the go, no-go sort of mission control stuff, that was when I knew that really kind of spurred the song into existence. But it's been the other way around in a number of cases, especially on the most recent album.
What would generally seed an idea or concept for an album?
It's hard to say, really. It could be anything, You could just be walking, you could be out walking, and the sort of the movement, something about movement kind of helps the brain think, I think, and kind of helps ideas sift through your brain and helps distract you so that you're not trying to come up with ideas, but your brain kind of comes up with them in the background anyway, or marries two different things that you didn't think about previously. Traveling is good for it as well. The kind of more historical albums we've done have always started with a period of research just based around reading, and because reading is so reliant on the imagination and not on kind of you creating these structures in your head in the first place, that often fires off all kinds of ideas and all kinds of sort of thoughts and processes for the way you'd like to cover certain events and the events that you'd like to cover. And at the same time, you as a musician, you're always playing music, either mucking around on stage before a show or picking up a guitar just to bash a few notes out, and it's kind of an ongoing process, really. It just kind of slowly coalesces.
With the bigger pieces of research that you've done, I'm assuming probably for your three albums, what's the process of acquiring all the old audio clips?
Well, with the stuff we've had from the British Film Institute, it's been relatively straightforward, which has been an amazing help, because I don't think we would have been able to get off the ground without them. So, we've got a long-standing agreement with them, and we kind of add titles from their archive as and when we decide we want to use them. So it's really flexible and really accommodating. We've built up a good relationship with them. With other stuff, and we had to go a bit further afield on the album we've just made, you know, going down to Swansea University and talking to the staff at the South Wales Miners Library and trying to get the rights for some of the interviews they had, you know, the kind of oral histories of 1985, looking back on the strike and its immediate aftermath, you know. Then it's often a case that they haven't necessarily done much of this kind of thing before, so, you know, we're relatively inexperienced still as well, so it's a case of sort of trying to come up with an arrangement that works for both of you. It can be quite fiddly. I normally try and stay outside of things, apart from maybe making initial contact and just explaining what it is that we'd like to do, and then hoping that, you know, behind the scenes it can get ironed out.
I just sort of have this picture in my mind of going to a smaller organisation. Some of the cataloguing might be perhaps shambolic?
It's not really been my experience so far. You know, it's BFI have always been great. You know, going down to South Wales Miners Library, it was literally a couple of shoeboxes full of tapes, and just going through the tapes. But even then, they were well sorted and well kind of cared for. And the librarians, you know, they were good librarians. So they actually brought me some material they thought might be useful themselves and sort of suggested a few things. And it's not been too kind of
arduous.
Yeah, not too arduous. Actually, the one thing that was slightly was getting hold of the artwork for the album, because I was kind of keeping my eyes open all the way along this process for the kind of thing that I thought would be right for the cover, and ended up going to a very small mining museum in the valleys, and there was a book in a cupboard, a locked cupboard, that sort of said publicly owned watercolours of South Wales, and I thought, well, maybe there's something in there, and had to go and get the woman from the museum, and, you know, she tried about 10 different keys in this lock, and I was sort of ready to give up, and you know, I was just like, I just want to look at this book, but in the end, she finally managed to get the door open, and, you know, just scrolling through that book, that was when I found Hannah, who did the artwork for the album. That's when I found her work, and, you know, it's little moments like that that kind of come together on a bigger scale that all kind of come together.
None knew when the foul air underground might not cause a disastrous explosion, or a landslide might at any moment bring down the roof and walls of the tunnel.
The internet and read an article about the space that you recorded the album in. Is it like a disused community hall, or is it now something else?
It is now a community hall, kind of reopened from a derelict building We're the National Lottery Fund, so it's now kind of engaged as a community space. They do kind of yoga classes and Zumba classes and, you know, classes for kids in there. And it is also a live music venue, so they put on, it's mostly kind of tribute bands touring through there who, you know, it's like a 300 capacity room, so they have a lot of those kind of bands going through. And it started off life as the Workers' Institute sort of lecture hall for steelworkers at the local steel plant. So it's had quite a long and interesting history. But yeah, once the steelworks went in the early 90s in Ebervale, it just went derelict for a while. And it was great that they managed to kind of turn it around because it's an amazing room.
How much of your new record did you record in there?
About 99% of it, actually. All the vocal stuff. All the drums. I think I did a couple of little retakes of guitar stuff once I got back home to South London, but it was, you know, it was pretty much everything in that room. And it was so weird getting home and listening to the takes, because we'd only ever heard it in that room before, and coming home and listening to it on speakers in a relatively sort of tight environment, it was like being back in that room again. It was very odd. We definitely captured something of the spirit of that room with the recording, if nothing else.
Being a used community hall, did you just have to block out a couple of weeks to knock out the album?
Yeah, and, you know, I'd looked at a couple of places. My wife has helped me, like, scout out locations and looked at a couple of places that looked great, but because they were community-oriented, you know, they just couldn't do that. But luckily, in January, they said they were always quiet. They don't book any gigs in there. There were a couple of kind of yoga-y things that had to move into slightly smaller rooms, and we did feel a little bit bad about that, but we hope that kind of the net benefits of what we did there was outweigh the inconvenience. But yeah.
Of the yoga and the Pilates.
Thursday nights was the interesting time, because there's a smaller studio sort of just up from where we were, and that was a Zumba class, and it was really loud, so yeah. we had to just do loud guitar parts in those days.
Now, I've noticed you've added a member to your band. I can't remember if there was just the two of you, if it was three of you when you were last down in New Zealand in 2015.
Just two.
You've added someone else, another multi-instrumentalist to your gang?
Yep. Try and cover as many bases as we can between the three of us. Yeah, he was playing with us in the UK when we came to Australia and New Zealand, but we couldn't really afford to do it as a three-piece, in those days. So he's kind of on board officially now, because he made himself so useful. He's on board officially as, like, the third member. And, you know, it's not ruling out, you know, bringing more people on board in future, because it's just the more musicians you can play with, the more fun it is and the better the show is. So
how does it,
in case of kind of, you know, finances really more than anything, it's just very dull.
How does it change the live performance having someone else on board?
Well, he's got a lot of energy, so that's good, because if you saw the show without him, you'd agree that me and Rigglesworth aren't exactly charisma on stage. So he's much better kind of getting the crowd worked up, and, you know, he's a source of kind of physical energy and movement on stage, which we didn't have previously. And that's before you even go into, you know, he's a very talented musician, so he's playing all manner of instruments. And it's another level of kind of musical engagement for people to kind of, you know, get involved with, really. But yeah, it's definitely improved the show no end, I'd say. And you know, hopefully if we had someone else in future, it'd be the same thing again.
How many instruments could we expect to see for your show?
Well, I'm doing probably three things that you could technically class as different instruments, maybe four if you're being generous. Riggles is doing two, so that's five, and then there's bass, guitar, keys, percussion. I mean, it's probably at least 10 between the three of us, and with a lot of kind of relatively, I don't want to blow our own trumpets, but relatively ingenious kind of looping stuff I haven't seen anyone else do before on stage, like, you know, play a shaker for two bars and that loops and goes round, so it is still live, it's just looped, the live, you know, live percussion looping within a band context I haven't seen before. You see people kind of like tap on a guitar and loop that, but
what sort of looping equipment do you use?
That is just using a couple of delay pedals which have long delay times, and they're kind of triggered by MIDI, so it's, the timing's relatively exact. But there's also quite a lot of just looping of MIDI parts, so not looping the audio, but looping the MIDI, so you can kind of manipulate the synthesizer sounds more fully, so you're not just kind of you know, just looping a particular refrain, and there's only so much you can do with that, whereas if you loop the actual note data itself, you can do all kinds of stuff with it. It's much more interesting, I think.
What could people expect from the show down in New Zealand? Is it going to be a blend of all of your music so far?
Yeah, all three albums. Probably weighted a bit to the most recent, just because, you know, those are the ones that, that's what bands tend to do, you know, play more off the recent one. But stuff from all three albums and, you know, a couple of rarities maybe, depending on how long we got. And it should be good fun. It's an unusual show, as you probably know if you've seen it. So hopefully people come out and give it a chance.
Fantastic. Awesome. Thank you so much. Hey,
You're welcome.
I really look forward to seeing you down here. And
we can't wait to be there, yeah.
Yeah, can't wait. You're playing a great venue.
Yes, heard lots of good things about it. I think it's going to be rather on the large side for us, but, you know, we'll see how we do. Cheers, take care, bye.
Public service broadcasting there. What was that chap's name?
Jay Wilgoose Esquire.
Is he the main boss?
He's the main boss.
We're looking at the poster right now. He's the one that wears the bow tie.
He's the tallest as well.
He looks the most British.
They're playing Thursday, May the 3rd at the Power Station. Get tickets from Ticketmaster if you can.
I'm looking forward to that.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.